Okay, we're going to read this passage beginning in Song of Solomon chapter 3 verse 6, and we're going to read down through chapter 5 verse 1. You will, I think, be struck with the imagery and the intimacy that is reflected in these words. And you're going to probably, as we read it, your probably mind's going to have a lot of questions as to what in the world could this possibly mean. And I'm going to do my best to try to explain that as we walk through it. But if the theme of chapter 1 was praise and admiration, or not chapter 1, but section 1, you remember that they lavished upon each other words of praise, expressions of admiration. Then the second section's theme was anticipation. As you might expect, when two lovers start heaping praise and expressions of admiration upon one another, what's going to happen is there's going to be this growing intensity of desire and anticipation of being together. And the theme of this third section is, I would say, consummation. I believe these verses are describing what happens on the wedding night and the consummation of their love relationship in marriage. And it starts with this wedding procession, verse 6, chapter 3. What is this coming up from the wilderness like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the scented powders of the merchant? Behold, it is the traveling couch of Solomon. 60 mighty men around it, of the mighty men of Israel, all of whom are wielders of the sword, experts in war. Each man has his sword at his side, guarding against the terrors of the night. King Solomon has made for himself a sedan chair from the timber of Lebanon. He made its posts of silver, its back of gold, and its seat of purple fabric, with its interior lovely fitted out by the daughters of Jerusalem. Go forth, O daughters of Zion, and gaze on King Solomon with the crown which his mother has crowned him, with which his mother has crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day of his gladness of heart. So that's the procession. Now he's arrived. He is with his bride. How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of newly shorn ewes which have come up from their washing, all of which bear twins, and not one among them has lost her young. Your lips are like the scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your temples are like a slice of pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with rows of stones on which are hung shields of a thousand shields, all the round shields of the mighty men. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies until the cool of the day when the shadows flee away. I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. You are altogether beautiful, my darling, and there is no blemish in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. May you come with me from Lebanon. Journey down from the summit of Amana, from the summit of Senir and Hermon, from the dens of lions and from the mountains of leopards. You have made my heart beat faster, my sister, my bride. You have made my heart beat faster with a single glance of your eyes, with a single strand of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine and the fragrance of your oils, than all kinds of spices. Your lips, my bride, drip honey. Honey and milk are under your tongue, and the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. A garden locked is my sister, my bride. A rock garden locked up. A spring sealed up. Your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits, henna with nard plants, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all the trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, along with all the finest spices. You are a garden spring, a well of fresh water and streams flowing from Lebanon. Awake, O north wind, and come, wind of the south. Make my garden breathe out fragrance. Let its spices be wafted abroad. May my beloved come into his garden and eat its choice fruits. That verse 16 there changes. It's Solomon speaking up to there. This is the bride issuing the invitation to come and enjoy. And then he says, I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh along with my balsam. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk. Eat, friends. Drink and imbibe deeply, O lovers. It's quite a bit to get through, but I think we can do it. Marriages in the ancient Near East were more often sanctioned through civil contracts rather than religious ceremonies. Most, especially Christians today, have their weddings in a church, in a religious setting. But this was not the case typically in that day. It was more of a civil matter than a religious matter. Ruth married Boaz, not in the temple or in the synagogue, but before the elders in the court, as another example of that. And the central feature of the wedding ceremony was a procession to the bride's home that was led by the groom, who came to retrieve her and escort her back to the new residence. And a wedding feast was given that often lasted for up to a week or longer. And though the wedding feast was prolonged, the bride and groom would come together to consummate their marriage relationship on the first night of this wedding feast. And the wedding feast is not described here in our text. The procession is, the consummation of their love is described, and it's presented in some detail with a lot of poetic, symbolic words. So in verse 6, we have the procession of Solomon coming to get his bride. The columns of smoke, perfume is not really smoke, it's incense that's being burned, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, and all the scented powders of the merchant. This represents the expensive, the costly nature of this display. The pomp and the beauty of this procession are completely appropriate in light of the significance of this event. What event in your life, are there many events in your life much more significant, much more important than that of the marriage to your lifelong spouse? It's a pretty big deal, isn't it? Very big deal, and very worthy of celebration, very worthy of recognition, very worthy of spending some money on it. No such thing anymore. I mean, if you do a wedding today, you're going to spend some money on it. So, but it's fitting that the union of a couple would be commemorated with a lot of pomp and in a special way. In verses 7 and 8, we have the 60 warriors accompanying Solomon's carriage. They were friends of the groom. And these were not just Solomon's friends. These were the noblest and most experienced soldiers. These were probably Solomon's royal bodyguard. And we see in these verses that they all wield the sword. They're experts in war. They've got their sword on their side, and they're guarding against the terrors of the night. Solomon has made provision for the safety of his bride and the protection of his bride, which I think is very appropriate, because that's one of the roles that husbands play, should take seriously in the relationship, is giving proper thought and planning to provide for our wife and family's protection. The carriage was made of wood from Lebanon, the timber of Lebanon. It's a sedan chair. It's ornate with posts of silver, the back of gold, the seat of purple. Purple is the fabric of royalty. And the inside of this thing has been outfitted by the daughters of Jerusalem. What happens usually when a bride's getting married? Her friends come around her and help to get her ready and to get the setting ready so that everything is beautiful and perfect for that wedding celebration. We see this happening here. And then in verse 11, Solomon has a crown with which his mother has crowned him on the day of his wedding. It's probably not the crown of royalty. It's probably just a crown of happiness, and not necessarily depicting royalty, although it could have been the royal crown. So, I mean, the groom has done this thing upright. He's set the stage. He has brought the best forward to present to his bride, to invite her to come with him to the consummation of the wedding of the marriage relationship. And now they're together. Chapter 4, verse 1. He sees her. And his response is, "How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are." He's praising. The first words that he speaks on their wedding night are praise of his bride's beauty. And three times on the wedding night, he tells her that she is beautiful. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. In the ancient Eastern world, women didn't typically wear veils except on their wedding night. You remember when Rebecca was brought back to Isaac and she realized that, oh, that's the guy I'm going to marry. What'd she do? She veiled herself until they were together. So also explains, you know, the story of Rachel and Leah with Laban. How could he end up with the wrong woman after knowing them so well? Well, there was probably a veil involved, and as well as darkness. So that was, I think, a common practice. Doves have been mentioned before. Her eyes behind the veil were like doves. Doves were known for their tranquility in the ancient world. And since the eyes are the windows to the soul, this is a compliment to what he sees in her character. He's praising her calm and innocent character. The hair, like a flock of goats coming down from Mount Gilead. I'm going to try that one on my wife. How well will that go over? You know? So, Julie, you got longer hair than my wife, and it's dark. So would you take that as a compliment? Your hair is like the goats coming down from the mountains of Mount Gilead. Yeah, you'd want to know. I need more information here, big boy. Come on. Well, the Mount Gilead was a lush mountain with great pastures. And in the distance, these flocks of dark goats coming down from the top in the evening down to the lower areas where the springs of water were, they would be clustered together and walking in rows. So in the distance, the dark rows of sheep, flocks of sheep against the green pasture background would be beautiful. So it really is a compliment in that context. I'm not going to try it, but that it was a compliment. Your teeth are like flocks of newly shorn ewes, which have come up from their washing, all of which bear twins. Bearing of twins means all the teeth are in place, but not any of them are missing. You got a top one and a bottom one that match. And they're beautiful, and they're white. And not one of them has lost her young, so everything is there. The lips are like scarlet thread. Your mouth is lovely. He's admiring. Just think about the detail with which he is admiring the beauty of his bride. And they're not necessarily all, it's not all necessarily focused on, you know, the sexual parts. This is admiring this woman's beauty. He's building her up. Her temples, which would have included, I think, the cheeks, are like slices of pomegranate. They would have been pink and flush behind the veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with rows of stones, which are hung thousands of shields. I think this is a compliment to her stately look, her elegant look. The towers of David that were built, were towers upon which the shields of valiant warriors were hung, as a symbol, as a reminder of their valiant and their bravery and their allegiance. So I think probably he's emphasizing not so much her neck's symmetry and beauty as he was making a statement about her as a person. I think this is a statement that's saying, you bear the elegance fitting of a queen that's going to be my bride. So he's building her up in so many ways. Verse 5, he mentions her breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle which feed among the lilies. I think he is, and I don't want to make anybody uncomfortable, but I think this is a reference to the softness and the attractiveness. They're like two fawns. When something, a small animal, a very small newborn animal, when it's first born, the fur of that animal is what? It's very soft. It's very smooth. And when you get if you pick up even a puppy, you know, a very small puppy, what is it that you like to do? You just want to stroke it because it feels good. I think this is a perfectly appropriate expression of his admiration for her body and for the way that God has made her. He wanted her to know how soft and gentle and how this soft and gentle beauty is kindling his desire, and he wished to express that desire with his caresses. Verse 6, he says, until the cool of the day when the shadows flee away, I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense. Most commentators believe that's another expression of the two hills, or the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense is another way, like in Hebrew poetry uses parallelism. It's another way of describing her breasts. And myrrh and frankincense were things that enhanced and the surroundings and made things more beautiful. This woman's body is beautiful and attractive to him. He's got much desire, which I think we can understand. In her eyes, verse 7, you are altogether beautiful, my darling, and there is no blemish in you. He sees no flaw, no physical defect. Now here's a question for you. Is there any such thing as a perfect woman with no flaw and no defect? Is there? There's one in my eyes. And who's that? It is my wife. You're right. It better be, and it is. And that's, I think that's the essence we ought to understand. That's what we ought to capture out of this. He's perfect, or she's perfect in his eyes. And that's how it should be. Because if she is perfect and she's the only one that's perfect in his eyes, then he'll have eyes for her only. And he will be devoted to her as it should be. So because this beauty is on display, he sees it, he's so compelled by it, attracted to it. He says in verse 8, "Come with me from Lebanon." This is where she was from, my bride. "May you come with me from Lebanon. Journey down from the summit of Amana, from the summit of Sinur to and Hermon, from the dens of lions and the mountains of leopards." I don't think she literally lived among lions and leopards. I think these were things that may have been sources of anxiety for her, threats to her peace and security. It wouldn't be a very comfortable thing to live among lions and leopards, because that'd be kind of dangerous. Those were threats. And I think he wants her to be built up from his praise and admiration of her beauty, that she's got such a sense of peace and security and tranquility in their relationship, that she's as ready to be with him as he is to be with her. And five times he calls her in verses 8 through 12 his bride. I think that confirms that this chapter is depicting their wedding night. Verses 9 through 11, here's his praise for his bride's love. You can picture this. You can picture this. Two people that have never been together. He says, "You've made my heart beat faster." I mean, what's going on here? This guy's excited. "My heart beats faster. With a single glance of your eyes, just a glimpse of your eyes, or just a single strand of the jewelry that you're wearing, anything I see about you just makes my heart go pitter-patter. You know, it makes it beat faster." That's neat. "How beautiful," verse 10, "is your love, my sister." My bride. Sister was a term, a very flattering and endearing term for one's wife in that culture. And then he says, "How much better is your love than wine?" What does wine do? Fermented wine affects our senses. And he's saying, The effect that you're having on me is better than any sensation I've ever experienced. Your fragrance of your oils than all kinds of spices. She must have had some really nice perfume. I wished I had that formula. You'd probably get rich selling it. "Your lips, my bride, drip honey. Honey and milk are under your tongue." Milk in the land of Israel, the promised land, was a land flowing with milk and honey. It was, I think, just like it was a fruitful land, right? It was a good land that provided and sustained the people. It supplied abundantly their needs. I think this he's saying, your kisses, your lips are going to be such a source of joy and such a satisfying way of us expressing our love for one another. In verses 12 through 14, I think he's praising her for her purity, her virginity. He says, a garden locked is my sister, my bride. Now, why would you lock a garden? You build fence around the garden. They built fences around the vineyards to keep things out that were going to destroy it. She is a rock guard, like a rock garden, sealed up, locked up, a spring sealed up. Sometimes they dig a well and cover it over with rock or with a large stone to keep others from getting there. I think this is indicating she had kept herself sealed from all others, preserving her purity for her husband. Verses 13 and 14 here are a metaphor of the garden. He's expressed how much he valued her purity, and because she's so pure, she is valuable. She is attractive. She is desirable. That's what all of these, pomegranates and fruits, henna, nard plants, nard and saffron, calamus, cinnamon, trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, the finest spices were all highly valuable, very attractive, very desirable. Then in verse 15, you are a spring, a garden spring, a well of fresh water and streams flowing from Lebanon. The you are expresses the fact that he has experienced it and it was everything he wanted. You are a garden spring, a well of fresh water. That well that was sealed has become to him a well of fresh water. What does a well of fresh water do to the thirst to the thirsty individual? It refreshes, it nourishes, it satisfies. And I think he is saying, you have been to me that which is satisfying and refreshing, like streams flowing from Lebanon. Then she says, in verse 16, awake, O north wind, and come, wind of the south. May my garden breathe out fragrance. In other words, all this stuff that you appreciate me, my lover, enjoy it. Let its spices be wafted abroad. Come into my presence and enjoy what's here. This is her invitation to him. May my beloved come into its garden, into his garden, and eat its choice fruits. In other words, here I am, my lover. Let's enjoy this experience together. Then he says in chapter 5, I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh along with my balsam. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk. What's that sound like to you? A description of a guy that's satisfied, appreciative. This marriage relationship has been consummated. And I'm not 100% sure about this last thing I'm going to tell you, but here's the way I think it means. The last words say, eat, friends. Eat, friends. Drink and imbibe deeply, O lovers. What's going on this wedding night outside of the bedroom chamber? Wedding feast, right? And I think this is saying, eat, friends. We got other things to do. Drink and imbibe deeply, O lovers. You all go on, have your meal, have your party. We'll get there when we get there, but we're not finished yet. We're coming back together for more because it's such a wonderful experience when it's done right. Right? I hate what our culture has done and is doing to the marriage relationship, the way that it's perverting it, robbing it. Well, they can't really rob it of its beauty and its significance because that was created by God Himself. But they have rejected. The culture rejects what God has created and ordained for our good and our satisfaction. Thoughts. Does this make sense, the way we kind of walk through it? Can you see that this is likely what's going on with all this poetic imagery and stuff? No questions? No comments? My wife was dreading it. You have to tell her that I was a good boy. Tell her. Huh? Tell her that I didn't cross the line. Got close to the line, but I didn't cross the line. I'm going to tell you, it's not what God has done to the sexual relationship that has perverted it. It's what sin has done to the sexual relationship that's what's corrupted it and perverted it. God created it as something very, very special and just like everything that God has created that is good, Satan has attempted to pervert and distort and twist and destroy. So we'll close with a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for love. And I thank you for the love of even the physical love. Thank you so much for the whole realm of connection and marriage, physical, emotional, intellectual, spiritual. Lord, the physical aspect of that relationship is good, designed by you for to be enjoyed and appreciated by both husband and wife in the context of marriage, and we're thankful for it. We thank you for the fact that it's exciting, it's satisfying, it's enriching, and it enables us to come together and a one flesh relationship. Lord, bless our marriages. Bless our physical unions. Bless us with marriages that bring honor and glory to you. Every marriage of every individual within this church. I pray that also for the marriages of my children and the children of our children that are here that are married, God. Let those marriages reflect the commitment, the purity, and the beauty that you've designed the marriage relationship to show. Just be glorified in our love for you, our love for our spouses, our love for others. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Don's going to teach next week because we're going to be gone. We have an opportunity to go celebrate our 46th wedding anniversary. So Don and I are going to drive down and spend Saturday night with her sister and then probably go to church with them Sunday morning and then Sunday afternoon, we're going to drive over to San Antonio and spend Sunday night, Monday night, and Tuesday night in San Antonio and drive home on Wednesday. So, no, I probably won't be back in time for Wednesday night, but y'all can meet. So, Don's going to teach. Brian Jackson's coming to preach next Sunday. So, don't tell him I said I had to scrape the bottom of the barrel to find somebody. But I don't feel that way at all, and he knows it. So, but thanks, Don, for filling in next week. I don't have no idea what he'll do, but 2 weeks from now we'll come back and tackle another section of this book.